From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist and broadcaster Tim Harford knows it's tempting for a lot of you to tidy things up. He's tidy himself, so he gets it. But his new book is about how being messy isn't actually such a bad way to live your life. And it may make you more productive and creative and, well, interesting. Harford writes about people who gave in to chaos and made amazing things, like David Bowie and Martin Luther King and Benjamin Franklin. He's coming to the defense of the untidy, the imperfect, the impetuous, and he says in his book, there's a certain magic to mess. Tim Harford will join us today to talk about throwing caution and order to the wind, not thinking about it all the time, just going for it. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You ever give a speech or a presentation and thought you had it figured out, thought you were prepared, but it fell flat because you stuck to the script or you sounded stiff and you didn't read the energy of the room? Or you spent days cleaning out your workshop or your office and all those clean surfaces just left you feeling empty and uninspired? Well, Tim Harford says those are the risks of being too tidy. He knows it's tempting to archive your emails and clean out your closet and button up and tuck in, but the risk of stripping out the mess is that you could miss something, a moment of spontaneity, a brilliant idea, something beautiful and wonderful and weird. Harford is a journalist, a broadcaster. He's an economist, too. He's a visiting fellow at Nuffield College at Oxford University. And his latest book explores the connections between creativity and messiness. It's called Messy: The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. I know you have talked about the fact that you've worked on the book for something like 5 years. You've also talked about how your wife provides comfort for you now, which made me wonder, what were you like 6 years ago in terms of your sense of chaos and messiness?
I had written a book called Adapt, which emphasized experimentation and failure and learning from mistakes. So that had already got me to loosen up a little bit. In some ways, it's a prelude to messy. But the truth is, I've always thought of myself as a tidy person. Yeah. And in fact, I think I'm still a tidy person. Yeah. If you came to my house and you walked into my kitchen, you would see clean surfaces, everything's been put away, the cutlery's in the cutlery drawer, the glassware's in the glassware cupboard. It's only if you went to my desk that you would see a mess. And I think writing this book has helped me understand why that's okay, and in fact why it's natural that there are some spaces that are tidy and some spaces that are messy, in a way that I previously would just have beaten myself up and thought of it as a bit of a moral failing, which is not uncommon.
Right. Well, it's interesting how this idea of the book appears at a time when it seems like there's this movement going on toward tidiness, cleaning up. And I have to say, I think people would be forgiven for being a little bit confused. I mean, on one hand, we're told to pare down, to make our lives tidy and be focused and mindful. And you're not really saying do the opposite, but it does seem a little confusing. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, in some ways, we live in very messy times. We have a very messy president who I'm sure we can discuss shortly, who's used chaos to his own advantage. He's used it very effectively. But the tidying up movement seems to be almost a reaction to that. And most famously, Marie Kondo's book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Let me tell you a secret. I love that book. It's a great book. I recommend it to a lot of people. I don't see it as being in conflict with messy. Yeah. We agree about something very important. Very early on in her book, she says, tidy systems, organizational systems, are a trap. So she argues if you want a tidy house, the only way to do it is to just basically throw away all your stuff. I'm saying, well, you might want to do that, you might not. But the point is that having some kind of system, buying more storage space, getting more filing cabinets, trying to impose order on what is fundamentally quite a chaotic system won't actually work. And that's one of the messages of my book, Messy.
Yeah.
But I also start to engage with some of the things that Marie Kondo doesn't quite get to grips with. So she says famously, oh, take each object into your hand and ask if it sparks joy. Mm. I say, okay, what about an email? What about a memo from the boss? What about all of these everyday work objects? If we work in an office, if we work through email, social media posts, we're constantly being bombarded with stuff that we need to do something with. Mm. And Marie Kondo's advice doesn't work. But my suggestion is this principle of trying to organize it, trying to impose some structure. She's still right about that. So we need to deal with email, deal with desks in a much more messy way. Mm. It turns out that there are some surprising things you learn when you start to keep a messy desk. So, for example, a pile of paper on a desk seems like that's a mess, right? Just a pile of paper. It's just a classic feature of any well-used desk. A pile of paper is not random. A pile of paper is actually self-organizing because you pick something out of the pile of paper and you look at it, you do something with it, you put it back on the top of the pile. And you pick something else out of the pile, you put it back on top of the pile. And you pick something else out of the pile, you put it back on top of the pile. What's happening to the pile? The stuff that you've touched recently is rising to the top like cream. And the stuff that you're not touching is sinking to the bottom,
yeah,
like sediment almost. So this pile is self-organizing. And at a certain point, you can pick up the pile and you can just have a quick flick through the bottom two-thirds and go, oh, yeah, I don't need any of this stuff. I wonder why it's on my desk at all. And you just throw it in the trash. Whereas the alternative temptation is this all needs to be organized. This stuff can't be on my desk. And what you do then is you take the stuff that with... given a few weeks to sink to the bottom of the pile, you would realize it's trash.
Yeah.
When it first arrives on your desk, you don't know whether it's trash or not. And so you file it somewhere. And then you'll never get rid of it. It's just taking up space in your filing cabinet. And it feels like you're organized. But you don't really know what that thing is. You don't really know how to deal with it.
How do you explain this temptation we have for tidiness? In another part of the book, you say we're seduced by the blandishments of tidiness. What is that impulse? Is that a human impulse?
It seems to be. I don't have a good answer. I do know it's incredibly common.
Yeah.
So my most famous case study of this is Benjamin Franklin.
Right.
And Benjamin Franklin, I don't need to tell you who Benjamin Franklin is. You don't need a Brit to explain who Benjamin Franklin is. But you may or may not know, it's quite a famous incident in Franklin's life. Quite early on in his career, when he was a young printer arriving in Philadelphia, he produces this thing called the Virtue Journal. And it's basically, he's making resolutions. He's going to drink less.
Yeah.
He's going to be more humble. He's going to do various other things. And he has these 12 virtues, and he just goes through every month as a different virtue he focuses on. He's trying to self-improve, and he's marking his progress, and he's very pleased with this. So in his autobiography, as an old man, he looks back 50 years and devotes a lot of attention to the virtue journal and how much it made him a better man. Except there's one thing that he could never do.
Yeah.
One of his virtues was order.
Order.
And he was famously a messy guy, messy desk, messy study, paper strewn everywhere. And his entire life, he's telling himself, if only I could tidy up, I would be a better person. Benjamin Franklin.
Right.
If only I had some more manila folders and a filing cabinet,
exactly.
I could really get something done.
Yeah.
It's just amazing that such a successful person could basically make that mistake. And the answer is actually, you tidy up if you want, but it probably won't help you. And it'll take a lot of time. I'm struck by, since I published the book, the number of very successful people who've come up to me and said, "Oh, now I feel so much better about my messy desk." And I think, well, but you're a very successful person. Why is it that you needed
Wonders.
Somebody to make you yeah. not worry about your messy desk?
Yeah.
Why were you beating yourself up?
You begin the book with this story that seems to really perfectly illustrate the theme of the book, and I thought we'd talk about this. This is in January of 1975, and there's this 17-year-old German girl, you write about Vera Brandis. And she has, in some way, managed to talk the great pianist Keith Jarrett into doing a concert in the Cologne Opera House. But the piano is a disaster. Tell this story, if you would.
So Vera is a jazz enthusiast, but she's clearly not quite experienced enough to be promoting a concert at the Cologne Opera House, which is 1,400 people. Yeah. And there's a mix-up, and the Opera House deliver this rehearsal piano. The white keys are sticking, black keys are out of tune, the pedals don't work, the upper registers are very harsh and tinny, and the most important thing about this piano is that it's not a full-sized concert grand, so it's too quiet. And it's the concert is late Friday night, near midnight. It's a sellout. Jarrett is supposed to walk out onto the stage and just improvise, because that's what he does. One man, one piano, no music. And the piano is unplayable. And there's no way to get a replacement piano, because it's 1970s Germany and it's Friday afternoon, everyone's gone home.
Yeah.
That's it. So she can find a tuner who will fix some of the problems, but she really can't fix this piano. And so Jarrett says, of course, this piano's unplayable. I'm not going to play. Yeah. And he leaves. And Vera Brandis then realizes that she's got no options except to throw herself on Jarrett's mercy. So she runs outside. She finds him. It's raining, which is one of the reasons they can't bring another piano to the venue. He's sitting there in his car. She taps on the window. He looks out of this window at this rain-drenched kid, and he thinks about these 1,400 people who are going to rip her apart when he doesn't play. And he just feels sorry for her. And he says, never forget, only for you. And then he goes back in and he plays this piano under sufferance in front of it's the largest audience he's ever played a solo concert in front of as well. It's a big deal for him. And he and his producer record that concert because they want documentary evidence of what a disaster sounds like.
Yeah.
But they don't get a disaster. They get the Köln concert, which is the best-selling jazz album, piano jazz album in history. It's a truly beautiful piece of music. It's life-changing. Two of my children were born while my wife and I were listening to the Köln concert. It's that sort of transcendent piece of music. And it's Keith Jarrett wrestling with the fact that he has to stick to the middle of the keyboard because the upper registers don't work. That makes everything sound soothing and ambient. But then he has to hit the keyboard with tremendous force to make it loud enough. So there's this tension between the soothing tones that he's using and the force with which he's hitting the piano. And it is completely electrifying.
Yeah.
And it turns out this is not actually that uncommon for some kind of problem to come up, some sort of obstacle, and people to find a solution they never realized existed and to excel themselves. But just like Keith Jarrett, we need to be forced. We need to be pushed into it. No, nobody just does this for fun. Well, that's not quite true. Brian Eno, who's another person we can discuss if you like.
Yeah, we will. We'll come back to him. He's great.
Produced David Bowie. He's a guy who does do it for fun.
Yeah.
But most people don't. Most people have to be forced.
So talk about what's going on with Jarrett then. As you say, he's forced to rethink what's going on. He has to pummel the keys in a way that he's not used to. He has to use a register he's not used to. So the idea is what? That he's having to find a new pathway to something. That's what made it great?
Yes. There are two things going on, I think. And you've used the phrase new pathway, which I think is a sharp phrase, is a good phrase to use. Because when computer algorithms are trying to solve very, very large, complex problems, for example, plotting an optimal route, you know, 200 cities around the US, what's the fastest way to get between them? Turns out this is a very, very difficult problem, finding the optimal pathway. What computer algorithms do to solve these sorts of problems is they're programmed to add randomness.
Yeah.
So you're looking to optimize, you're looking to find the best route, but then you throw in some randomness. It sounds strange, but that prevents the algorithm getting stuck.
Yeah.
In, you know, what seems to be a good approach, but it's a bit of a dead end. And it's not just algorithms. Classic example from, I'm speaking to you from London. We have our London Underground system. Many hundreds of thousands of people moved around the London Underground every morning. There was a strike. Industrial action closed half of the tube stations a couple of years ago. And economists got hold of the data of people using a smart card system to get around the London Underground. Mm. And what they found was they could identify people who took the same route to work every single day for months, for years. And then on the day of the strike, they had to find a different route because their preferred route wasn't available. And then they never changed back because the shock had prompted them to try something different, and they found out that the different thing worked better. So that's part of what's going on. I think there were actually two things going on with Jarrett. Partly it's you try something new because you have to, and it turns out it's better. Very, very common. Not necessarily very mysterious. As I say, a computer algorithm can do it. A commuter can do it. But Keith Jarrett could also do it. There's another thing going on, which I think is a bit more mysterious and psychological, which is about attention and the sense of threat of a difficult situation. Yeah. When we're in a very familiar situation, we relax, we feel comfortable, maybe we feel a little bored, but we're so comfortable we don't want to get out of what of our habits. And that's really the enemy of creativity.
Yeah.
Whereas when we're fully engaged because the situation is exciting, we're not bored, that sparks creativity. And there are different ways to do this. Maybe it's a sense of play. People can be very creative when they're playing. Having some kind of game, engaging their sense of wonder. But they can also be very creative when you engage their sense of threat. And this is really what was happening to Keith Jarrett. He felt really threatened, really under pressure. He was forced to try something new. So like the London Underground, he was experimenting with a new path. But he was also, and can you imagine the focus of the man having to improvise with this piano that he knows is completely inadequate, and, he can't play the upper F sharp, and that key sounded terrible, don't play that key again. All these things he's having to deal with. He could have played that piece on any piano. It just never occurred to him to try.
Yeah. I remember years ago seeing the Martin Scorsese documentary about Bob Dylan, and in it, I think this is where I heard him say this, or I may have read it, but he talked about how those bursts of creativity when he was younger maybe passed him. That it was kind of a lightning in a bottle or something, and then it just kind of went away. And it made me wonder if Dylan or McCartney or anyone could create masterpieces again, because those conditions, if you think about Dylan, now that he's wealthy and comfortable and confident and acclaimed, are the circumstances not even there for him to be brilliant again? Do you know what I mean?
I do, and I think it's very difficult later in life to achieve that sort of conceptual breakthrough. There is actually a very interesting study of this by an economist called David Galenson, who's at the University of Chicago, who studies the creative careers of pop musicians, of fine artists like Picasso and Cezanne, and poets, and studies this in many different spheres. And Galenson's insight is that, and you can see this when you look at when people achieve their great breakthrough, there are basically two types of creativity. There's the Dylan, the Picasso, mm-hmm. where suddenly someone just emerges like a thunderclap with a new idea, just a new way of doing things. And they tend to be very young, Dylan and Picasso were. And then there's the craft that just comes from decades of perfection, or just trying to perfect your art. Cezanne is an example. Leonard Cohen, I think, is another example. Mm-hmm. Just the number of different iterations that a song like Alleluia had to go through.
Yeah.
Or Johnny Cash, that amazing sort of late career flowering that he had when he was just drawing on decades of experience. So, but it wasn't like a conceptual breakthrough, because I think he was very, very comfortable in this space he'd found. So I wouldn't say that you hit 50 or even you hit 30 and you're past it, but you certainly have the capacity to control your surroundings more and make yourself more comfortable. And I think with that control comes danger.
It's interesting you mentioned your two children, two of your children being born while Keith Jarrett's music is playing.
And my wife now feels rather ambivalent about this piece of music.
I bet. But it did make me wonder the part that music plays in your wanting to explore this subject or tell the stories. I mean, it seems like a common denominator in, I mean, we'll talk about Brian Eno here in a moment, and there's David Bowie, and of course, you know, we already talked about Jarrett, but it seems like
And Miles music. Davis as well. Yeah.
And Miles Davis. We'll get to Miles Davis. That's a great story. So music is a common denominator here in some ways. Maybe just for you, or is it just good illustrators?
It just seemed to be where a lot of the stories were. I love music in a way that I can speak about music a little bit in a way that I can't speak as knowledgeably about, for example, sculpture. But I do try in the book to touch on architecture, for example, Le Corbusier and the Building 20, and the tactics of a particular German tank commander in the Second World War. And so I do try and apply it more broadly. But yes, there's a touchstone there with music. Well, Miles Davis is an interesting one. Of course, Miles Davis is famous for improvising. There's a lot of jazz improvisation going on. But I think two things relevant to what we've said. One is that Miles really, I think, made a creative breakthrough when he went to Paris, hooked up with an old girlfriend. She introduced him to a young film director who, when Miles was away from all his lawyers, persuaded him to record a soundtrack to this French film noir. It's called the Elevator to the Gallows, I think. The Elevator to the Gallows. Or Echafaud or something. I'm getting it wrong, I'm sure. But so Miles gets together with a bunch of musicians he's never played with before, and they watch this movie and they jam in the middle of the night. Yep. And it's impossible, given the constraints, to do the kind of jazz that Miles was doing before, which was bebop, quite hard, very technical, fast jazz. So instead he had to adopt this rather sparser, sparer, more haunting. I mean, sometimes he sounds like he's playing the trumpet at the bottom of the well. He's got so much echo on it.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of jazz. It's much more moody and atmospheric. And that really, I think, paves the way for Kind of Blue, which comes, I think, 2 years later, if I remember correctly.
Well, there's one story in particular I was really intrigued by. So this is 1959, and you write about how one of the most famous solos, in fact, of all jazz, really comes after Jimmy Cobb whacks his drum cymbal just a little too loudly. But this is such an improvised moment, and it becomes, and he goes with it, Davis.
Yeah, and Miles Davis is, when they're recording that, he's very forgiving of ambient noise and rustling. He's like, oh, that all goes with it, it all goes with it. And in general, in that album, pretty much everything is the first full take.
Yeah.
Now, they get the technical details right, and then they play it once, they play it again, and they don't use the second take. They just use the first take. The feelings are there. But in this particular case, it's So What, which is the track, the very famous track that begins the album. And it begins with this duet between the double bass and the piano. It's out of time with the rest of the piece. It's quite unusual. And then the John Coltrane and Miles Davis come in, and then Cannonball Adderley as well, I think, if I remember rightly. Mm-hmm. They're playing the brass. And then Jimmy Cobb, he's switching brushes for sticks, and he accidentally just whacks the cymbal too hard. And in that moment, Jimmy Cobb assumes the take's going to be called off because he's made a mistake. But as this loud crash of this cymbal is fading and resonating, Miles Davis launches into this solo. It is, as you say, one of the most famous solos in jazz history. And everyone just keeps going, and that's it. And it's magic. But the other thing about that album, of course it's improvised, improvisation was what jazz musicians do, is at the end of the album, in his autobiography later, Miles says, that wasn't what I was aiming for. And people say, oh, you're putting us on. It's a classic, it's a brilliant album. He says, yeah, I'm not saying it's not a good album. I'm saying it wasn't what I was aiming for. I wanted a completely different sound, more kind of African finger piano sound. And the brilliance of somebody coming to the studio with an idea about what he wants to achieve, missing it, and instead creating this masterpiece, and not the temptation surely must have been to assert control, to say, this isn't what I imagine, we need to change direction, to put his foot down. But no, he just goes with it. And at the end says, yeah, that wasn't what I wanted. But it's kind of blue. So that's it. Incidentally, the same, David Bowie, Brian Eno tells me, he worked with Bowie, David Bowie had the same thing, that there would be something going on that was, it would be almost perfect, and then somebody would make a mistake, and Bowie would go, whoa, whoa, that mistake was much more interesting. Yeah. And they would put something that was nearly finished to one side and go with a more interesting mistake as something that was worth exploring. Very unusual, very brave, but Miles Davis had it and David Bowie had it.
So explain why, because you write about how this a shock of chaos can have these magical effects, but help explain it, because you say there's something psychological here in part, but there's also something really technical, almost mathematical, introducing this dose of randomness. So explain that if you would.
Yeah. So this is the algorithms that we mentioned before. So the idea is, let's say you're trying to find your way to a summit. There's this landscape, you're trying to find your way to the top of the tallest hill in this landscape, but you're blindfolded, you can't see. Computer algorithms mimic this sort of process all the time in all kinds of things. They're designing jet engines, they're trying to plot logistical algorithms, they're designing computer chips. And it all maps to this idea of fumbling around this landscape, trying to get to the highest point, but you can't see what the landscape looks like. So you're just having to try stuff out. So how do computers do this? Well, one approach is to say, I'm going to feel around my feet, and whichever way is uphill, that's where I'm going. And I'll just keep doing that. I look for step by step by step uphill. So you're looking for these tiny incremental improvements. That's not a bad way of trying to find a summit. But the trouble is, what you end up is you end up on the top of the whatever hill you happen to be on. And maybe it's just you're next to a pitcher's mound. So you wanted to climb Everest, but you just end up on top of the pitcher's mound. Because once you're on top of the pitcher's mound, every direction is down, and so you have to stop. So you've got these algorithms that are looking for these small incremental improvements. They're trying to go uphill all the time, and they get stuck. And the dose of randomness is what gets unstuck. It says, okay, you've been exploring this part of the landscape for a bit. Try something totally new. Try and go there and do your hill climbing thing. Feel around, look for improvements, try that for a bit. Then go to a third place, again, somewhere new, an experiment. And using these techniques, there are various different ways to do this, but basically computers solve near impossible problems because they're too complex, using this combination of looking for gradual improvements, but just throwing in doses of randomness. It turns out to be very, very powerful and really not dissimilar to what happened to Keith Jarrett, for example. Yeah. He's got the skill, he's looking for the great piece of music, but first he starts with this massive shock to the system, which is the unplayable piano. That seems very mysterious, but there is, as you say, there's a mathematics to it as well.
It's Tim Harford. He's a journalist and economist. His latest book is called Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist and economist Tim Harford is joining us to make the case for making a mess. His book is called Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. I have to ask you about how Donald Trump fits into the story, because he is in this story. And I want to begin with this message that you received from a friend. This was, I think, back in 2015. This friend of yours who had been noticing Trump's method or technique, if you can even call it that, of campaigning, his kind of off-the-cuff technique. The fact that his Twitter tirades were capturing all the attention. And your friend wrote this to you. He's in the OODA loop.
Yeah. He's in their OODA loop, I think.
Their OODA loop. Yeah, that's right. He's in their OODA loop. Yes. Now explain that.
So my friend and I had been talking about an idea in my book, which is based on the idea of, so far we've been talking about mess using mess as a way to organize your desk, maybe, you know, paradoxically, it actually helps. We've been talking about using mess to be more creative. What about using mess as a competitive weapon? What about using mess to put somebody else at a disadvantage? And that was an idea I was exploring in the book. And I'd been looking at the doctrines of a U.S. Air Force pilot called John Boyd.
Yeah, he's great.
Who is, he's got a very well-known kind of, by military geeks, everyone knows who John Boyd is. Not so well-known outside the military. And Boyd had lots of interesting ideas. But one of them in particular was this idea that to do anything, you need to observe what's going on, orient yourself. You know, how does what I'm planning to do fit with what's going on? Then you have to decide what I'm going to do, and then act. Observe, orient, decide, act. It's called OODA, the OODA loop. And the basic insight is, well, if you can observe and orient yourself quickly, then you can decide and you can act quickly. But then when you act, you have to, you force your opponent to restart his OODA loop. In other words, you know, you change the situation, then he has to stop and think. Mm. And it's, of course, because it's military, it's all kind of this crazy bit of jargon. But the basic idea is, I will move so quickly and unexpectedly and keep surprising you, and you will have to keep stopping and engaging in a reality check and trying to figure out what's going on. And while you're trying to figure out what's going on, I'll do it again. You have to stop again. And so a fast-moving force that's able to improvise, that's able to act in an unexpected way, can completely paralyze the opposition by constantly surprising them and forcing them to reevaluate. That was Boyd's idea, and he had observed it initially in air-to-air duels between fighter planes in the Korean War. Like a plane, even if it wasn't so fast, even if it wasn't so well armed, if you had good visibility and you understood what was going on, you would always win because your opponent kept being confused by what you were doing. So that's the OODA loop. My friend worked for environmental campaigning organization Greenpeace, and he was interested in using the OODA loop as a campaigning tool to confuse multinationals. That we're going to organize a protest and we're going to catch them unawares. And when they get there, they'll be preparing their press release, and then we'll do something else that will catch them unawares. So one classic example is the Greenpeace invaded a nuclear power station and said, security at nuclear power stations is terrible. Look, we managed to invade one. And the power company, this was in France, the power company said, well, yeah, but they didn't manage to get through to the nuclear reactor, and we've got them now. And then Greenpeace said, really? Because it turns out there are more activists who've invaded other nuclear power stations. See how long it takes you to find them. And it was this kind of, they were just one step ahead. That's what my friend was talking about when he emailed me about Donald Trump. That Trump's ability, whether you admire him or not, his ability as a campaigner to grab the spotlight and to keep changing the conversation over and over again. So early on in the Republican primaries, he would say something that would cause offense, and then Jeb Bush would go and meet with his focus groups, and he would be just about to come out with a statement, and then Trump would have moved on to something else.
Yeah.
And then Jeb Bush would retreat and focus group something else, and he'd come back. Donald Trump's changed the conversation again. And he, I think, was less successful in doing that against Clinton, although clearly he got the result he wanted.
Yeah.
And I think he continues to do that now. Doesn't necessarily make him an effective president, but he does continue to control the news agenda to a surprising degree. You remember, it wasn't very long ago, Jeff Sessions, his attorney general, was under suspicion of, did he perjure himself and testifying in front of committee, and there was this big scandal, and it was gone in 48 hours.
Yeah.
Because Trump was onto something else. So I think people who are opposing Donald Trump, to the Democrats, their challenge is, and to some extent the media who are trying to hold him to account as well, the challenge is, can we actually keep the story still long enough to examine it and get people to look seriously at things that we're concerned about? Or will Trump be able to change the dialogue yet again?
Yeah.
It's a remarkable technique. But usable in politics, usable in military engagements, usable if you happen to be working for an environmental campaign, and used also, I think, very effectively by Jeff Bezos at Amazon as well. So it's like it or not, it does seem to work.
Bezos, let me just mention something from that. You tell a terrific story of the German general Rommel, who would describe the leadership qualities of the British as schwerfällig?
Schwerfällig.
Ponderous. Clumsy and slow and tidy-minded, but there's this great character, and people have to read the book to get the story. It's David Sterling, who plays Rommel at his own game, and Bezos has a similar technique, and he actually tells his management team to spend less time communicating. Say something about that, because that's a really interesting part of the book.
Same thing, and this is an idea that goes back to this Air Force thinker, John Boyd, who said synchronization isn't for soldiers. Synchronization is for watches.
Yeah.
So you spend all your time trying to synchronize with each other. That just slows you down. So everyone's just got to go out there and do their own thing as quickly as they possibly can, react to whatever the situation happens to be, because it'll always be unpredictable. Make the best decisions you can, keep moving, and synchronize later, coordinate later. And that was exactly what Jeff Bezos advocated at Amazon. He was very conscious, particularly early on, the first 5 years of Amazon, this idea the World Wide Web has been established, there's this opportunity, we have to move really fast. People forget how small Amazon was, how vulnerable it was. Everybody thought it would be crushed by Barnes & Noble. If it wasn't going to be crushed by Barnes & Noble, it was going to be crushed by Toys R Us, they went into toys, or by Walmart. Of course it would be crushed by Walmart. And Bezos said, no, we're just going to move so quickly. By the time these big organizations have done all their committee meetings, mobilized all their funding, and put their top managers on the project and really taken the internet seriously, we'll be onto the next thing, be too quick to stop. Yeah. And it was a very conscious decision. And that was in that spirit he was saying to his managers, don't call another meeting, don't check with each other, just do it. Talk about it later, but just do it.
Yeah.
And don't communicate seems crazy, but he recognized that is part of the just get on with it and do it, and because it's the communication that slows you down. What you get, of course, when you do that is an incredibly chaotic organization. Now, if you'd been sitting in Amazon in those early years, the late 1990s and early 2000s even, you would have said this is a catastrophe. This is just anarchy. They have no idea what's going on. The warehouses are just stuffed with Pokemon Jigglypuffs, and they don't know where they are. And everyone's working 22 hours a day, and the whole thing's completely unsustainable, and everything's breaking down. It's only if you took a step back and looked at what was happening in Barnes & Noble, who were just utterly blindsided by this, or at Toys R Us, you would have realized, okay, it's chaos in Amazon, but it's chaos for a reason. And the same thing, I think, is true of the Trump campaign. And the same thing is true of in military situations sometimes. Rommel, the German tank commander, if you'd been with Rommel's army, you would have said, these guys are idiots, they don't know what they're doing. It's only if you took a step back and looked at what was going on in the British, who were just paralyzed because Rommel was moving so fast, you realize, okay, mess can slow both of us down. But if it slows you down more than it slows me down, I'll embrace the mess. That works.
Yeah, I think the question of how this works in a workplace is interesting, because this idea of having your own kind of individuality and control is important. And I love the story you tell in the book of the French families who lived in homes designed by the architect Corbusier.
Yeah.
And these buildings were, of course, modern and gleaming and designed with mathematical precision with all these straight lines. But these people who lived in these homes, they defied these designs and they kind of made them their own.
Yeah, they put traditional sort of French wooden louvred windows on the outside of the beautiful, simple concrete cubes, and they put pitched roofs on them, even though they didn't need pitched roofs, and they built little picket fences outside them to mark out little gardens, and they decorated the gardens with garden gnomes, which are, I think, the least modernist thing imaginable. And of course, it looked like a mess from the point of view. I mean, I'm a fan of Le Corbusier's aesthetic vision. Yeah. I think his homes look beautiful, but he didn't respect the fact that this wasn't actually what the people who lived there wanted.
Yeah.
And they just made their own homes. And ultimately, it's their homes. They lived there. But I really thought of Le Corbusier when I then reflected on what a lot of modern workplaces are like. When you get the top architect in, you get the top designer in, and it's all going to look like a magazine shoot. And obviously not every workplace is like this, but when some company decides it's going to spend a lot of money laying out this brand new office, and we'll, you know, the New York Times magazine are going to cover us and we're going to look great, you've got this same thing where order is imposed on workers. This is mandatory fun, clean desk policies. It's going to look super, super cool. Everyone has to keep moving around because that's in part of the vision, hot desking. And the offices look beautiful. They look so beautiful, and they're so often completely dysfunctional.
Yeah.
And it's the same problem. We actually want our garden gnomes, but the corporate hierarchy has the ability to prevent us from having them.
Tim Harford, he's a journalist and broadcaster and economist. His latest book is called Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Tim Harford. His latest book is called Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. Say something quickly, if you would, about the story of Building 20 at MIT. This was a building that was, this was during World War II. It was decidedly untidy, ugly and dysfunctional, or at least people thought it was, supposed to be torn down, but it had this magical kind of presence to it.
It was thrown up in an awful hurry to accommodate Radlab, which was working on radar. It was incredibly important. Many Nobel Prizes came out of Radlab. Mm. So Building 20 was designed in an afternoon, built in a few weeks. They called it the Plywood Palace. It's basically just this, like a very big garden shed, several wings, three stories, uncomfortable in the summer because it's too hot, too cold in the winter, full of dust and a fire trap. And people just get lost. And the whole thing was just a terrible, terrible building, except amazing things happened there.
Yeah.
And not just the radar. Once the radar effort had moved on and Radlab just went on through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, Noam Chomsky revolutionized linguistics there. Those iconic photographs of the high-speed photographs of the bullet penetrating the apple and the apple disintegrating, taken by Harold Egerton. They were taken in Building 20. John Cage, the minimalist composer, went into an anechoic chamber in Building 20 where he could hear only the sound of his own heartbeat. And he realized there's always a sound. Even in a chamber like this, went out, wrote 4 minutes and 33 seconds, the perfect piece of ambient music. The first atomic clock was built there. I mean, just, you could go on and on. The hackers, the MIT Model Railway Club, who basically founded hacking, they were operating out of Building 20. It's an amazing place. And I think there were two things going on. One was the freedom. People could do whatever they wanted. So when Zacharias, the scientist who built the atomic clock, when he to accommodate the atomic clock, didn't just have to knock down walls, he had to take out two floors. He just did it. No one cared.
Yeah.
It's just this terrible prefab thing. You could make architectural alterations with a hacksaw. And that was, that sense of freedom was very, very important to the residents. The other thing was, because it was such a mess, it was low status. And because it was low status, basically all the new interesting things got thrown in there together. And nobody cared about them, nobody paid any attention. And they made wonderful collaborations. It really reminded me of the early days of a lot of Silicon Valley companies like Google. We think of Google as being, oh, you know, the cool canteen and the pool tables and the slides and the helter-skelters and the ball pits, all of that. But actually, when Google became Google, it was a bunch of engineers working in these really shoddy, temporary spaces. The one thing they had going for them was the engineers controlled them. They could make them work however they wanted. And that control continues to be very important. There's some great psychological research into it, but I think you just reflect on your own life and you can look at successful companies. They're often very messy places.
I want to ask you something you write about toward the end of the book, where you write about these algorithms, like dating algorithms, how they try to get things just right, but that they lack something. You say trying to get a romantic partner can't be tidily measured, that there's some chaos involved in that process. And it gets to this larger point, it seems, about algorithms, that they want us to keep coming back to a virtual world. But you're talking about connection. Sherry Turkle, you mentioned, that sociologist, you know, face-to-face interactions are awkward and difficult and messy. But it seems like that's another theme in the book is... Being human is messy.
Being human is messy, and mess is a human characteristic. Sherry Turkle, in her book Reclaiming Conversation, describes a conversation with a teenager who says he wants to communicate by text or WhatsApp or some other social media. He doesn't want to communicate face to face. Why? Because it happens in real time, and you can't control what you say. I think it's such a sad statement, but it also tells you that's what's great about a proper conversation. It happens in real time. You can't control what you say. That's why it's human. The same thing, I think, is true of a lot of these dating websites. I've got nothing against internet dating, but I find it fascinating that many sites have held out the promise that if you give enough information to the computer will find you the perfect match. And we believe this, even though it is clearly absurd, because actually, when you think about any successful romantic relationship you've had, what made it successful could not have been specified in a spreadsheet. It wasn't the fact that you had a shared love of tennis. You know, it wasn't the fact that you had a good sense of humor. Well, I mean, maybe it was, but you can't put good sense of humor in a spreadsheet. You can claim you have a good sense of humor, but you can't really measure it. So, and this goes way back, before there was internet dating, way back to computer dating by mail in the 1960s out of Harvard. There was a dating operation called Operation Match. Mm-hmm. And this was the thing. Tell us everything about yourself. We'll find you the perfect partner. What actually they did was to match people on zip codes. So, you know, you're a guy looking for a girl. You're a girl looking for a guy. You live near each other. The computer has found a match. And actually these things worked really well because people would show up for a dinner date, and then they spent the whole date trying to figure out why the computer had matched them. So they'd have a real conversation. It worked. Mm. Worked very well. And the more modern site, OkCupid, did a similar version of this. They told people they were very compatible when in fact they weren't. And they wanted to see whether people still formed relationships. And they found whether you were 30% compatible, or whatever that means,
right,
or 90% compatible. It didn't make any difference as long as OkCupid said you were 90% compatible. So it's all just nonsense. Computers are great because they alert us to the existence of people who are looking for love. They help us meet people. But the idea that they would actually be able to find a match, I think, is completely illusory. And I think it points towards a bigger illusion we have about what can be controlled and what's inherently unpredictable in life.
So how do we make our lives a bit more messy? Do we force ourselves into moments of randomness, try ditching old habits, try new ways of working, mix it up from time to time? What do you suggest?
All those things work. A couple of specific suggestions. One is just to pay attention when a loss of control has happened and something's happened that you didn't expect. And just try to be like Miles Davis to say, well, that wasn't what I was aiming for, but is it something worth running with? So just rather than resisting the unexpected, to embrace the unexpected when it happens, because our lives are full of unexpected things. That's one thing. Just a sense of, like, a state of mind, really. Second, you can make a note of things you might want to do, places you might want to go, people you might want to meet, that you're a little nervous of doing. Write down a number. Say you list six things. Number them 1 to 6. Roll the dice. And the randomness, the fact that you couldn't quite control what it was going to be, can be a real source of enrichment. I try this from time to time. I don't do it a lot, but I try it from time to time. And it's always interesting when you're dealt a hand that you didn't expect, but you force yourself to try to play it anyway. It's amazing when where you get. Brian Eno, the composer, producer who helped David Bowie make these amazing albums in the 1970s, he used to have a deck of cards with random instructions on called the Oblique Strategies. Yeah. And they would just get, when people were stuck in the studio, it would break them out of this creative rut and get them thinking about something new, something different. And when I was talking to Brian about it, I said, would you use them a lot? And he said, I would only use them when I was stuck. I don't use them as a ritual. I use them when I'm stuck. And then I said, do you get stuck often? He said, oh, yeah, all the time.
I love the story about the card that he showed you that said water. What did you learn from that?
That one of the things about these cards, this unpredictable nature, is that it can be a source of communication. So you put out a card and the card just says water. What do you make of that? Well, the answer is, well, if you're a band working in a record studio, maybe you should have a conversation about what you make of that. Maybe somebody's saying, well, I need a drink, we need to take a break. Somebody else is saying, no, the card is saying the music is kind of insipid and doesn't have any strength or structure to it, like water. Or it could mean anything. But the fact that you've got this random stimulus you have to make sense of, it's a starting point for a conversation. And the unexpected in our lives often is a starting point for a conversation, which, as we've discussed, is uncontrolled, is messy, and that's why it's fun.
Tim Harford, his latest book is called Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Michael Havey. Zoe Wolf-McGinn is our intern. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.